Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Patricia Auftier-Hada. I'm a university professor in the School of Communication at American University in Washington, D.C.
And it's wonderful to see you. We had a good gossip yesterday, but other than that, this will be our first conversation for 15 years, maybe, something like that.
It's been a minute. It has been a minute, yeah. Yeah,
one of my longest
minutes. I think you were last at Riverside, yeah.
Yep. So I'd like to start by asking you if you would share with us the things that are currently dynamizing, preoccupying, worrying, interesting you.
That's a great question. And I think the things that are driving me forward are the things that have always done so, only now it feels even more urgent. I think it's just really important to figure out how to have hope in a very bleak time, a time of worldwide anti-democratic movements, a time of climate crisis, a time sort of global monopoly in terms of late capitalism, and just. And at the same time, so many movements of resistance and demands for human rights. Anyway, I think my work generally is about finding community, finding the ability to act in the world, finding the ways to. Have agency, to take civic action, to have some control over your world, and to have the sense that that's going to be possible even in a time when these crises seem to be very overwhelming.
And I know from our chat yesterday, Prof, that you're doing some of that right now where you are. Could you tell us a wee bit about that, perhaps?
Sure. I would say that I have cheered myself up since I first began to have any agency by doing this kind of thing. But what I'm doing specifically in Korea right now is working with documentary filmmakers here on interpreting the copyright exceptions that they have, which include fair use, which is a U.S. copyright exception. It's the most biggest and most flexible copyright exception in the world. None of this used to be in the least important until we got very long and strong copyright in the world, which we did in 1976, when the U.S. passed an extremely extensive Copyright Act that extended and expanded the range of copyright and suddenly put us all in the position of needing to understand how to have any escape from copyright monopolies, which by definition are private censorship. So I've been very lucky for the last two decades to work with some brilliant lawyers, including my co-author, Peter Yassi, at American University, in figuring out how to work with creative communities to establish how they employ fair use. And that's made it much easier for everybody to use fair use. It has changed industry practice. It has made it possible for people to do many more things that they had been frustrated about doing. If you see humanities courses online for OpenCourseWare, that is due in part to people's clarifying what their fair use rights are. And Korea adopted fair use in 2011, although it hasn't been clear how to interpret it. So I'm exploring the consequences of not knowing how to interpret it and documenting those, and also sharing what I think are going to be helpful materials that we developed in the US, which I think are going to be able to be used here. So that's work that I think is work on freedom of expression issues, as well as on industry issues. And it lets me hang out with documentary filmmakers who tend to be idealistic. They are the sort of the nonprofit part of the film business, and they have the most amazing stories that they want to tell with the most amazing people. So it's a really great way to enter the Korean reality here.
And
It's a lot of fun.
for those who may not know the concept, could you give us a brief primer? And I should say that your work with Peter Yazzie is fantastic, and he's a wonderful man. I haven't seen him for decades, but I thought a lovely person when I knew him a
Oh
bit.
yeah, he's just as lovely as he ever was.
Oh,
And
great.
he has trained up generations now of people to follow in his footsteps, which is wonderful. And I get
Great.
to work with those people too. But of course, copyright monopolies allow the copyright holder, who rarely is the creator, to be able to have control over that work. They can say whether another person can use it. They can say how that person can use it. They can say how much they have to pay to use it. And the copyright exceptions, which include fair use, are legal permission to basically break that copyright monopoly under some circumstances. And what fair use is a limited right to break other people's copyright monopoly. It says if you are using that person's stuff for a new purpose, not the purpose that it's on the market for, you're doing something else. Well, then what you're doing is creating new culture. We love that. Copyright law wants people to make new culture. So go ahead and do that, but don't use more than you need for that new purpose, or that is appropriate for that new purpose. And that might be 100% in some circumstances, but have a reason for why you have to use what you're using for a new purpose. Because otherwise, you're just taking somebody else's stuff for the reason that they actually have control over it and might even be wanting to sell it. So don't step into their market, but be making new stuff. So every child who ever wrote a term paper or composed a report is employing fair use because they're quoting from other people's work. Every college student, every college professor, many, many, many documentary filmmakers, and some fiction filmmakers, every artist who ever made collage, everybody who ever did a remix, all of those people are employing fair use. Oh, on every journalist ever. So all of those people are employing fair use, often without realizing that they're doing it. It doesn't bother them at all because they understand intuitively that what they're doing, they're quoting for a reason to do something else. The reason that you have to do the kind of work that we've been doing for the last 2 decades is because people, when they move out of the most familiar areas, they get confused. As they get especially confused because they've been through 2 decades of the, or 3 decades of large media companies telling them that it's a crime to copy anything, which, will come as big news to every elementary school teacher ever, because copying is how people learn. But because all those people have been through that terrifying experience of being told that you wouldn't steal a car, so why would you copy somebody else's work? They have some questions when it's not, often when it's not text. They're confused about music, they're confused about images, they're confused about audiovisual materials. So they're like, well, it's okay to quote somebody's words in this academic article, but what if I'm writing an academic article that's about music and I want to quote the music? And fair use applies just as much to that as it does to the text, but you have to know that. So
Yes,
we didn't
absolutely.
get
And
to
I've
help for a minute, and now I'm really excited to be extending that work in Korea.
copyright attorneys that I've spoken to think that if anybody ever had the whatevers to stand up to Warner's or Paramount, that fair use might be much greater than it even appears to be. But the problem is intimidation by corporations.
Oh, I don't believe that at all. People stand up to Warners every day, and people get money from large media companies that claim that they're doing fair use, but they aren't. And because people understand their fair use rights, they go to companies that, like broadcasters, that have been taking chunks of their movies and claiming that it's fair use and saying, no, I actually do understand what fair use is. The reason why people sometimes say that is because their attitude is, well, what we really need is a test case. But big companies are not stupid. They really have good lawyers, and those good lawyers really understand copyright law. They really understand fair use. And under no circumstances are they going to sue. Disney, for instance, doesn't even sue on fair use when it could. It lives on fair use. It owns ABC, wouldn't do that. It sues on trademark, but it doesn't sue on fair use.
Yes. Well, I guess these lawyers I know are wrong, but that's what they say to me, that it's not a matter of,
That is not our experience at all.
well.
That first of all, you don't need a test case because you can't get one. If you could get one, you'd have to wait for somebody really stupid to sue so that you would lose in the they would lose in the right way. And that those people are not around. And when they show up, like Yoko Ono actually initiated an injunction, which all an injunction is it says, stop this person from doing this because I think I might want to sue them later. But if I wait, they will already have this, they will have done something that would prejudice me. So
Yeah,
what the judge has, what, pardon?
I remember getting a cease and desist letter from Canal Plus, but it was not exactly a cease and desist. It was we might make this a cease and desist letter,
There's a
saying
lot
that.
of they're free, plus which French law is not, French law doesn't have fair use.
So they wrote and well, they wrote and said, right now, what you did is free publicity for us, and we appreciate it, and you can keep doing it. But if it ceases to be what we see as useful publicity, we will sue you.
I don't understand. I don't know French law, so I can't tell you what they're doing. I can tell you that anybody can write a letter like that, and that doesn't. They can even say that they're Canal Plus, and they're not, and nothing bad will happen to them. So yeah, there's that. No, I think if we waited for the judges or the lawyers to tell us what we could do with our rights, we would be in terrible shape. And we don't do that for other parts of our rights. We don't wait for permission.
No,
So
I see that, but it just gets interesting if you're thinking about what it would mean to republish a book that is in copyright and say, I'm not doing this for financial reasons. I'm doing this because I'm worried that this person's work isn't getting sufficient attention. So here it is.
well, that would be a copyright violation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you yes, there's a book on the market. You don't like the way it's distributed. It does not give you permission to copy the whole book and let it everybody else have it. No, it does not.
Well, see, that's what my friends think you could do.
Oh, God bless them. Well, don't get legal advice from those people, okay? At least if you're in the
Legal
US.
advice I've ever gotten that I've taken cost me vast amounts of money, and I didn't get what I wanted. So
That
I don't have a
happened.
good track record. In any
We
event,
have a
so.
20-year unbroken history of providing people, helping people to make tools that are useful, uncontroversial, and have never gotten anybody in trouble. So I will recommend to people that they look at cmsimpact.org/fair-use, which is the entire suite of our materials on fair use. They're unremarkable, they're uncontroversial, they're simply usable. They're not copyleft. They're just helpful guides.
And where do you, this is, I'm just going to that page so I can share it with listeners. This is Fair Use Library, is that right?
I'm going to put it in chat. And here is the grandfather of all of them. Oops, sorry.
Yes, it's Fair Use Library. That's what it's called.
Great.
Wonderful. And tell me how you got interested in this, how this became important for you.
Actually, Peter Yassi invited me to a conference he was having with other lawyers about how restrictive copyright was effectively censorship of new culture. And I sat through the whole conference and I was like, does anybody have any data? And he was like, oh no, lawyers don't do data. We just propose theories and ideas. And I was like, well, I hang out with filmmakers. That's who my people are. And they never complain about this stuff. They complain about people, digital piracy and the threat of them not having being able to control their copyrights. So is there, I would like to see more than a bunch of lawyers opining about culture. I'd like to see people who make culture show me how this is a problem. And so we got some money from the Rockefeller Foundation to do that. And we went to filmmakers and we interviewed them at length. And the most interesting result, we got a lot of great information about copyright problems, but to me, the most interesting thing was the point in the interview when you'd say, well, have you ever had to stop making a film because of copyright problems? And the filmmaker would say, oh, no, that never happens. And we'd say, gee, you just spent 40 minutes telling us all the problems you have with copyright. There's no rate cards, it's behind a paywall. People, estates are giving you problems. There are multiple layers of rights in television footage and music. How is it that you've never been able to? You've never had to cancel a project because of all these problems. And they're like, well, I'm a professional. And you never undertake a project that you can't finish. And we were like, really? So what kinds of projects would you never undertake because you couldn't finish them? And they'd be like, oh, well, yeah, sure, we can tell you that. Like, don't do anything about music, popular music, and don't do anything about popular movies, and don't do anything about politics because you'll end up having to get clips from TV news, and public affairs. You'd have to reference all that news stuff. Don't do anything funny because somebody else might not think it was a parody, and then you'd be sued. And the list got really long, and we were like, oh, okay, so you're not going to do history, and you're not going to do current affairs, and you're not going to do popular culture, and you're not going to do humor. And now remind me again, you're the people who tell truth to power, right? And they were like, well, when you put it like that. So that was a report that we wrote that was it was an eye opener for the field because they had really come to think of themselves as very put upon, very besieged by the terms of their business, but since the terms of their business were unchangeable, that was just what they had to do to be professionals, and they had to work within those limits. So we had them interested, and we then worked with them, and we said, you know, the law is never going to be very robust in this area in terms of lawsuits, because the business, you know, lawsuits have to be undertaken against people who have money. You guys are mostly lawsuit proof because you don't have any money. There's very little case law on fair use because everybody in the media industry really likes it, and they do use it. And they have no interest in screwing it up. So you might have to assert for yourself what you think should be normal. And they were like, well, if you know, if pigs had wings, they would fly. You know, we have insurers, and insurers just won't accept fair use. And we have broadcasters, and broadcasters won't accept it. Theaters, film festivals, Sundance won't accept, you know, of our films unless we get insurance. Won't happen. And we said, look, let's just live in an as if universe for a minute. Let's just develop a thought exercise where we say, what should be able to happen because it is reasonable, it's ethical, and it's within the law? What should we be able to do? And that's, we worked with five filmmaker organizations. We worked in 10 cities. We met with filmmakers for either a morning or an afternoon. We fed them. And they talked to us for 3.5 hours in small groups about what they should be able to do and what they thought the limits of them, what the limits of fair use should be, given that they themselves were copyright holders. That ended up with a highly specific document that didn't say, this is what fair use is. It said, these are the four most common ways in which we need fair use to show up, and here's how we think it's appropriate. And we ended up with that whole exercise, and everybody was like, well, that's nice. I'm glad you talked to us. It's not going to make any difference. But we did publicize it. We publicized it at Sundance, and we published it in those five different organizations' magazines. So there was a big blast between January and March to publicize it. And by summer, every insurer had changed their practices to accept fair use. That made a big difference to broadcasters. It made a big difference to filmmakers. Ultimately, it made a big difference to film professors. And here's the thing that I thought was really exciting. It changed the way that people made films. That's for sure. People started making more history films. They made more films about popular culture. They were able to make films that cost less money and that were less stressful for them. They imagined better work from the beginning. But here's the thing that I thought was so interesting from a viewpoint of agency. There's a law that I'm really not in love with called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And among other things, what that law says is it is a crime in the United States to break encryption on a file or a DVD for any reason. Even if you have a right to access that material, you cannot break encryption because that is a criminal penalty. Now, copyright is not criminal, it's civil. But this is actually a criminal penalty for which you can go to jail, breaking encryption. There's so many things I don't like about that. However, there it is. It's a US law. It has a little escape hatch in it that says if you cannot do your work for some reason because we created this law, you can come every 3 years before the copyright tribunal. It's part of the Copyright Office, and explain to us what you do that needs to break encryption, and we'll consider giving you a waiver. Filmmakers were like, well, we have a right to use fair use. We understand that. It's normal. Everybody uses fair use. But we're not able to use fair use because of this stupid encryption. We are going to the copyright office and going to complain to them. And they did. And they won the waiver. And having won the waiver for documentary filmmakers, they went in again and said, oh, the fiction filmmakers need this too. And they won the waiver for fiction filmmakers. And all kinds of other groups have now gone before other groups that have understood their fair use rights, partly because we were able to work with them, have gone before the Copyright Tribunal and said the same thing. They're like, well, we do media literacy teaching and we need to be able to break encryption. And oh yeah, we do fan fiction. We need to break encryption. Somebody showed up in a tutu to say that, by the way. It was a really delightful moment at the Copyright Tribunal. Security experts, people who study hacking and are trying to keep systems digital systems secure, they need to break encryption in order to test it. They've come before the Copyright Tribunal, and there's a whole right to repair movement
Indeed.
for independent car repair and truck and tractor repair people who are also showing up at the Copyright Tribunal and winning those waivers. And that is a movement that's not, I'm not attributing that to all exclusively to our work, but when I see that people who worked on those codes of best practices for their little community decide that they need to show up at the Copyright Tribunal, I'm like, look at that. You know, it's political organizing, it's agency, it's good. It's good.
So
They understand their rights.
you're the copyright Saul Alinsky.
Well, maybe not, but okay. Yeah.
Darling,
Yeah,
get off the keyboard, please.
it is really a fun project because it's bringing a lot of good news to people.
He's biting my hand. Sorry. So,
I'm sorry.
yeah, darling. I think what we should do is, while we re continue recording, I think somebody will stop attacking me if he gets more food.
Yeah, go get some food for the guy.
So let's put him on the shoulder, support his bottom, and keep recording. So, in all seriousness, Pat, when I said the Saul Alinsky of copyright, this does seem as though it is a really important thing. And ironically, one of these cultural exports from the US about which we can feel sort of good. Yeah. The idea of
Yeah, I
fair
can't say that the
protecting
American
and
government
liberating.
particularly wants to export it, but yes, it's as far as I can tell, the American government would prefer that other people not notice how effective it is. But they mostly want to export the Copyright Monopoly Act aspects.
Yes. Now, I can remember when we first knew one another, and the Clinton people brought out the 1996 Telecommunications Act. I think you produced a book about that, didn't you?
I did. Michael Shudson, who is a wonderful person and a dear friend, I wrote this book. It's called Communications Policy in the Public Interest, colon, the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And
Yes.
I told Michael that I had written this book, and he said, I hope never to read a book by that title, but if I do, it will be yours.
So, could you tell us what was important about that act and what it seems to have enabled or produced in the years since?
So the moment of 1996 was that was a law that was in play for the previous 2 decades. And it was about how we are going to regulate in a world where broadcasting, cable, and telecom are overlapping into each other's areas. And it was a big, messy law. That is also the law in which we got Section 230, which is the that's the part of the law that says that internet internet platforms are not liable for third party for the activities of the people who are using their platform. So if somebody commits an act of libel on Yelp, it's not Yelp's problem. And also that in the process of hosting these sites, it doesn't take away their freedom from liability for them to moderate, for them to make sure that the ways in which they let people on the platform are appropriate to the needs of that commercial platform to have its brand identity, et cetera. And this is that's controversial now because the Trump people and then Elon Musk went in and said these platforms are censoring and discriminating against conservatives. Partly because those platforms, a lot of the major platforms, Twitter, Facebook, the major social media platforms were trying to take down misinformation, disinformation, and some of that was coming from right-wing sources. So you Section 230 is part of the 1996 Act, but the one of the notable long distance effects of that act was to increase the monopolistic quality of our internet. It was supposed to increase competition. The argument was this will increase competition among, it will create the possibility for broadcasters to get bigger so that they will be able to compete with telecom. And cable, which they just got bigger. Cable and telecom created these mergers. So basically everything got bigger. There was less regulation of the competition regulation, what we call in the United States antitrust law in place. Safeguards were removed. So it was a big food fight for a very long time between the broadcasters, the cable casters, the telecom, the internet people. And everybody got something. Nobody got everything of what they wanted, except for the public, which did not do very well. There were these carve-outs for the public. In stuff like E-rate, which is a sop to the notion of universal service in broadband. How can we, if we're going to have competitive broadband provision, which by the way, we don't, but in theory, if we were to have competitive broadband provision, then how do we also make sure that people don't completely fall off the network? One of the solutions to that was to get a subsidy for schools, for public schools to have broadband. There were many things that were wrong about the way that that happened. Among them, that the privileged providers for that service were incumbent providers who wanted to do that in the most expensive possible way and still do. So there's a lot to not love about the 1996 Act, but it was structuring for the world we have today.
Yes, absolutely.
That, everything bad that happened in radio in the US, the rise of those large those large services like Sinclair,
Right. Which is a right-wing Christian company for people outside the US to know.
you need to deal with your cat before he kills you.
I don't know what it is right now that is going on with you, darling, but you have to stop because Prof. P is not dedicating her time to therapizing my feline relationship. Her time is too valuable for us to waste it.
Well,
Okay.
I'm not so sure about that, but in
Anyway,
any case.
so I guess one of the things that's happened with antitrust more generally is that successive administrations over the last 40 years have degutted it. And
Yes, it has been gutted. It has been gutted for decades, but in those decades, nobody has stepped up to fix it. The Clinton and Obama administrations had opportunities that they rejected. So, and Biden has not been able to move on that, although Biden did appoint Lina Khan to the FTC, which was a bold move. Lina Khan is there at the FTC without even the most basic tools to do her job because antitrust law is so weak now.
This is FTC is the Federal Trade Commission, folks. So moving on from that, Prof. P, you've mentioned that you're doing some work with these filmmakers in Seoul, and you're inspired by that, and it seems as though there are some elements of fair use that are being successfully exported, as it were. Although you're in some ways a US policy wonk and an activist, you've also got extensive experience living and working in other countries and learning from other countries. And I wondered if you could talk to us a little bit about that.
So actually my PhD is not in communication. My PhD is in colonial Latin American history. That was a product of another great policy initiative in the US, which was the Defense Department's decision to pour gigantic amounts of money into universities to establish area studies programs. So that wherever we the US invaded next, they would have some expertise. I'm not kidding. That is exactly what the project was.
Benedict
It's,
Anderson's memoir
you know,
is.
they were proud of it. They said it out loud. They wrote it into the law. You know, it's not you don't need any deep critical skills to figure out what they were up to. They loved saying that. And so they were in the 1960s and 1970s, they were giving out fellowships to do graduate study like there was no tomorrow. And you could not find enough people to take the money. And people like me, who didn't have a better idea and did not want to join the corporate workforce, were like, sure,
I'll do.
fine. You
Sign me
know,
on.
you want me to study Bengali? All right. So I studied Bengali for 4 years, and then I got an MA in South Asian history and a PhD in Latin American history, and went to India for a while, and then worked in Brazil for years. And the pool of people who took those area studies degrees. I took a degree in history, actually, but the money was distributed through area studies. Those people fell into two camps. One was the people who were like, and now I know a lot about Kurdistan and the problem of the Kurds. And yes, I would love to work for the CIA. Or USIA, or you know, any of the other organizations and
The
acronyms that
USIA, folks, is US Information Agency, which outside the US was actually called the United States Information Service to make it look as though it was less a governmental tool.
but it totally was a project of soft power. But so there were those people. And then there were people who looked at the same information that they had learned in their studies and said, "My God, colonialism and imperialism are the vehicles by which capitalism becomes a world order." And, armed with that information, one must do something. And that was people like me. So you had a population of people who either turned to the right or turned to the left, and there was nobody in the middle. And that was what happened to me. And it was living overseas, I think, that was very deeply helpful to me in sort of decolonizing my own mentality. Not that you ever get completely decolonized, but being provided with other perspectives is actually something that's pretty difficult for Americans. It's a very parochial imperial culture. So I was very, very lucky that I was able to work with the people that I worked with. Many of those Latin American historians, they were wonderful. They were people who did really pioneering work on the history of slavery in Brazil, for example. I hope that my work also contributed to that. But when I left the field, because I actually didn't want to do colonial history for a profession, I left it to become a left-wing newspaper editor at In These Times. So I went into that with a fairly deep, diverse cultural experience. Also drawing from my own life experience, because I come from two immigrant families that speak no mutual common language, except English. So I was able to bring some of the deep questions about how culture gets formed that I'd been working on in my PhD dissertation. But one of the driving questions of my own PhD work were how does the culture of capitalism get formed? Capitalism becomes a culture along with a lot of other stuff. And so how does that develop? How do people's understanding of what's normal change from the time of the original great empires, which of colonialism, which are the Spanish and the Portuguese? But I brought those questions to the cultural project of the newspaper, which I ran the cultural section of the left-wing newspaper. We were democratic socialists. We discovered this weird guy in city council in Burlington, Vermont, who was named Bernie Sanders. We were big on John Conyers and who was on the left wing of the Democrats in Congress and so on. So we spent a lot of time looking at stuff like that. And I brought those cultural questions to the newspaper, which was really, really terrific. And since I came to the university, which was that was like kind of my third career, I've been able to take advantage of my sabbaticals to live overseas as well. And I did have the privilege of living in Australia for half a year. Well, and Australia is just really perplexingly full of people who study copyright exceptions. And I'm absolutely not quite sure why that is. But you have absolutely brilliant people at nine different universities in Australia doing really interesting work. And they all talk to each other. And they haven't managed to really fix copyright law in Australia yet, but they are on the move.
Going back to In These Times, Prof, if I could, what was it like adjusting from writing a doctorate to writing copy for a paper?
Well, I had been a film critic from the time I was 17. So I was always a reporter and I was always a critic.
Right.
And I had developed as well a kind of national presence in some of the film magazines, partly because there was a film critic called Pauline Kael who wrote for The New Yorker. And she was publishing a book, and I got to meet her because I was writing a review of her book, and she was doing a tour, and I got to show her my clips. And she actually became a champion of mine. And her big advice was, you know, I don't care how what I don't care how big you are regionally in the Midwest, it won't make any difference. You know, I know you're in five states. It just doesn't make any difference. You have to get to the coast and you have to get national. So she was, that was good advice. And she was very supportive. She later got me another job. And it was, it is a, it's another thing that I think is really important in our lives to recognize how important that mentorship is of people who go out of their way to say, you know, you can do this. It's something that we do as teachers that I think is really important to just be supportive, to create possibility, and creating possibility in organizing movements is also really important.
So for you, in fact, writing, reporting in different modes was always part of life. And I'm just thinking about how you've
Yes.
written in so many genres. Across your career, it's amazing. Now, one of the things in your forthcoming book that you kindly shared with me in draft form is that you write very movingly about those social movement days, those very much Saul Alinsky-inspired social movement times in the Midwest in Chicago. And of course, that's
Oh,
allegedly
Alinsky was in Chicago. Yeah.
right, and that's allegedly the inspiration for Obama, of course, in his earlier life. He cites Alinsky a lot. I'm wondering if you could take us back a bit to those days and whether they seem different in terms of social movements from now.
You know, I think, it kind of depends on where you were and what moment you were in, because things changed very quickly. You know, there's a pivot point between 1968 and 1970 where there's a radicalizing of a lot of the movements, and there's an enormously self-destructive process as well, where a lot of those movements implode. But I think if I look back at the folks who were young then, like me, in the mid-60s to mid-70s, I don't think we could have possibly imagined that things would be as dire now as they are. If I think we believed that as we won things, they would stay won. You know, the idea that you could have a true feminist revolution, and in our own era lose the right to abortion, that would have been very hard to imagine. When I went to college, I went to college in 66, and nobody cared if women went to college then because you were just there to go find a guy to get married to. That wasn't me, but that was everybody else's attitude about me. And by the time I graduated from college, people wanted to hire me because they were like, we don't have enough women. We need to have women here because, like, you know, it looks bad if you don't have some women. And I was like, wow, that is not what I would thought I was gonna happen. You know, I thought I was gonna have to fight a lot harder. But all these women had really, you know, done some real work for to pave the way for me to just waltz into a lot of situations because the language had been developed that, of course, women are people. But when I went to college, you needed to get a man, either your husband or your father, to open a bank account for you. That wasn't true by the time I graduated from college. So things moved really quickly. And I think one of the assumptions we had as young people was like, I was just going to keep going like that. That didn't happen. There was also some of the extremism was really appalling because people, some of these, like the Weather Underground was, in my opinion, just crazy. I don't know how they thought the world was going to change by what they did. Clearly they didn't grow up where I grew up, like they were going to have to convince a lot more people than they convinced that change was possible and important. And they had a vanguardist philosophy that didn't work out. People like me, people like the In These Times people like the people who worked at Kartemquin Films, people like Bernie Sanders, they were in a democratic socialist mode. They were like, no, there is a common good. There is a need to support policies that defend that common good. Capitalism cannot be savage capitalism. You democracy is your protection because it is participatory, because publics act as checks on power. And that was a very different thing from believing in armed revolution.
Prof, I've got two more questions for you, if I may, and then I'd like to invite you to add anything you may wish to what we've said. Does that sound okay as a way of concluding? Great. I've worked out why the cat is being such a bastard. I think he's got sibling rivalry with you over your hair colors.
Oh yeah, that's it.
He just is, now that I found a way of moving your image away from him, he's calmed down. I had to, wash a wound and put a plaster, a band-aid on it while we were recording, but whatever.
He
I
just wants
think
to, yeah. See, he's like, that's a cat.
that's an orange girl. And I'm not too sure how I feel about this.
Oh,
Anyway.
God, that's funny.
Last two questions, Prof. One is about the filmmaking group you just mentioned, and that is so important in your forthcoming book, Kartemkin. And I wondered if you could tell us a wee bit about them.
So Kartemquin Films was started in 1966. It continues today. It's founder One of its founders continues to be involved, Gordon Quinn. It has made these Academy nominated films and award-winning films like Hoop Dreams was a film that they made in the 90s, and more recently a film called Minding the Gap went to the Oscars a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. And it has consistently, since the 1960s, made social issue documentaries that are informed by the philosophy of John Dewey, who was a American pragmatic philosopher who articulated the importance of the social phenomenon of publics in making democracy work, and publics not being just random people like public opinion, and not being official groups or representative groups, but being groups of people who share in common a problem that they need to solve and need to organize to put pressure on power to change. And what Kartemkin was founded to make movies that instantiated that philosophy in storytelling. And it has never lost that sense. And all of its films maintain that ideal and exercise that ideal in the storytelling. They're really noted for the respect that's shown to the people in the film and the respect that it is shown to the people who watch the film. It assumes that people are smart, they're curious, and that the people who you're telling the story about and the people you're still telling the story to are all people who are sharing these common problems in the world that they need to take agency and action in. So the most famous filmmaker is Steve James. He's one of the films, he's the director of Hoop Dreams, but he also made some recent series that are really important, actually. America to Me and City So Real. They're both set in Chicago. And one of them is about a school in a town that was founded to push back against segregation, but in which de facto segregation continues to exist at the school. That's America to Me. And City So Real is about the politics of a mayoral election in Chicago and about the rising voices of people whose political voice has only occasionally been heard in Chicago, which is a lot of the working Black people.
And Prof, you've actually half answered what was my last question. I was going to ask you about pragmatism and its philosophical influence on you, particularly Dewey. But in your book, you also cite Jim Carrey, who, of course, was a big Dewey fan. And you also cite Stuart Hall. And I wondered if you could perhaps help me bring together pragmatism and cultural studies, which Jim did in lots of ways, I think.
Yeah, actually, I don't think I think that John Dewey distanced himself from the cultural left in general because of Stalinism and the politics of anti-communism in the United States. But that he actually shared a lot of concerns and vocabulary with those people. And I've always felt like a very opportunistic person in relationship to communication theory. I have always been looking for people who could help me figure out how people imagine something different than what it is, and then build something different from what it is. Because that happens all the time. But we didn't have a great vocabulary for it. Gramsci actually lived that story. He was like, how are we going to do this? How are we going to build the ways in which we change people's minds? If people can't imagine it, then they can't do it either. And the people in the New Left and the people in cultural studies in the New Left worked very hard at those problems and wrote great stuff that is fairly hard for me to read, but also lived their theories in practice. So when Stuart Hall was working with all of these Black filmmakers in the 90s who made these amazing decolonizing films about being Black and British, when he was working on the problem of police brutality and why so many Britons were willing to accept it, with people of color in his community in Birmingham, he was working on very specifically how do you create cultural projects that intervene in consciousness? And that was what John Dewey was also about. He wrote a lot about art and the function of art in society and about education and the function of education in society. And he thought those were two really, really important social institutions for how people changed their expectations and their notion of what reality is. Of course, like Stuart Hall is, he has that wonderful on that whole way of reminding you that reality is entirely constructed, and it's all about how we interpret what's around us, that there's no independent place for reality to reside. And if that's true, then what Jim Carrey said is right, that reality is just a continual battlefield. And that means all of us are fighting in that battle. Anybody who's communicating is fighting in that battle. And we're on some side when we do that. We just have to figure out what the implications of what we're doing are, because we are always having an effect. We're either reinforcing or challenging what isn't working.
That's wonderful and inspirational. Thank you so much. And to conclude, are there things you'd like to add to our discussion? Things we might have touched on, but you want to go into them in greater depth, or something we've not mentioned?
No, I would just like to say thank you to you, Toby, for the work that you've done over the years. It has really been inspiring for people like me who are not who learn from theorists but have no pretension to building theory. I have depended on you and other people in cultural studies to give me guidance and help me understand how to take action in the world.
Oh, well, that's so kind of you. You've been an inspirational figure to many of us for decades. So it was wonderful chatting with you. I loved the more personal stuff we did yesterday. I loved your tolerance as I dealt with Puss in Boots. But most of all, I loved learning from you this afternoon, as I have on so many occasions before. Thank you, Patricia
So
Aufderheide.
I'll be listening to your podcast as well to continue to benefit from your vast network of smart people.
Thanks.